You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Today, let's hop in the car and take a quick drive over to Dodger Stadium.
All right, let's take a look.
Over the past year, it's been a lot more than just a ballpark. It was a COVID testing site where more than a million people got tested. It was a voting center, a Holiday Lights drive-through show, a socially distanced tailgate location where Dodger fans sat and watched the boys in blue take the World Series. Now it's changing roles again.
And taking what here at Dodger Stadium has been the largest testing site in the world and transforming it into the largest vaccine site in America.
L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti announcing there that Dodger Stadium is becoming the largest COVID vaccination site in the country. Friday was day one, and they administered 2,500 shots. Saturday, they administered another 4,800. The goal is to reach 12,000 shots every day by the end of this week. KCRW's Kaylee Wells has more on how it's going.
When Tiana Herrera got the email from her boss with the information to get a COVID-19 vaccine, she grabbed the first appointment she could find.
I want to get it as fast as I can. So it just so happened that Dodger Stadium still had availability, and it was the next day. So I'm like, okay, I guess I'm going to Dodger Stadium.
She works with developmentally disabled adults, so she counts as a healthcare worker. So she made the drive from La Puente.
Well, here we are at Dodger Stadium, gonna get the vaccine. No line. Well, actually, there's that line right there, but it's not as congested over here.
But instead of a long line, there was a sea of empty cones.
They have a bunch of cones set up, you know, you're kind of driving through what it's like, probably like Speedway, like some go-kart stuff.
The empty line was reminiscent of a weekday at Disneyland. Once she showed the documentation proving she was a healthcare worker, she and a group of cars were funneled into one of several vaccination pods.
They rolled down my window. They have like this little cart where the vaccine's at, like maybe it's an ice chest, and the vaccines are in there. They go, there's probably like 4 carts going around, just giving you the vaccine.
After the required 15-minute recovery period, her group of cars was released to make room for the next wave. She made it through in 45 minutes. It helps that the site at Dodger Stadium started as a testing site, and that right now it's operating at less than half of its capacity. But the teams working there had less than a week's notice to nearly double the number of staff and triple the physical size of the operation.
There was a lot of planning that had to be done in terms of, you know, just thinking out, how do the cars come into an area? How do you make sure that they're off the main street? Where do we place our teams to make sure that they're doing the right documentation and the checking? You know, how can we divide it up so that we can get the maximum amount of people through safely and still get vaccinated, then observed, because you have a 15 to 30 minute observation period of time, and then leave safely.
Ann Lee is the CEO and co-founder of a nonprofit called CORE. They provide disaster relief, usually in hurricane-prone areas, but during a global pandemic, they're all across the U.S. Standing and overlooking the operation at Dodger Stadium, she called this the most important project she's ever done in her 15 years of disaster relief work.
It's so different because when I was in a different place, there was the affected community. But being here, we are the affected community. I'm worried about my family. I'm worried about whether or not we're going to be safe and our team's going to be safe. It's very different. Knowing that the sort of immensity of COVID right now in our lives, I have to say in the 15 years of doing disaster response, it is the most important thing I've ever done in my life.
For now, Dodger Stadium is still only open for healthcare workers and people living and working in long-term care facilities. While other counties have moved on to residents ages 65 and older, Mayor Garcetti says the county just doesn't have enough shots for the nearly 500,000 people remaining in the first vaccination phase.
Right now, as we focus on continuing to help our healthcare workers and the residents and staff of our skilled nursing facilities across Los Angeles County, protecting those who are both the most vulnerable and the riskiest to us, we're going to make sure that we keep them safe so they can keep keeping us alive.
But local health officials predict that could change in just a couple weeks. And while the majority of Californians are still months away from getting the vaccine, Herrera says even knowing that, once she got the shot in her arm, she felt like the end was in sight.
when the nurse gave me my shot, she's like, oh, congratulations. I was like, you know what? Yeah, this is kind of a good, you kind of feel like, okay, this is it. This is a light at the end of the tunnel. The pandemic's almost over.
For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
On this day that honors the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
It's been almost 60 years since Dr. King made that famous speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, seen by throngs on the National Mall. This Wednesday, at the other end of that mall, on the steps of the U.S. Capitol, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will be sworn in as president and vice president. Now, normally, there would be huge crowds to celebrate that great occasion and the peaceful transition of power, but the COVID-19 pandemic has made large, dense crowds too dangerous. And the transition, yeah, it hasn't been very peaceful. After the attack on the Capitol 2 weeks ago and threats of violence from Trump supporters across the country, the mall is now surrounded by layers of 8-foot metal fencing and thousands of National Guard troops in every level of law enforcement, from Secret Service to local police officers, there to stop domestic terrorists from trying to attack and overthrow the government. There is a strong racist theme throughout many of those groups, so it seems like a good day to ask, how far has America come in the quest to realize Dr. King's dream? Aaron Aubrey Kaplan is a journalist and the author of Black Talk, Blue Thoughts, and Walking the Color Line, Dispatches from a Black Journalista. Aaron, welcome to you.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be here. Happy King Day.
And Isaac Bryan heads up the Black Policy Project over at UCLA. Isaac, welcome.
It's good to be with you, Steve.
Aaron, I'm going to start with you because this past summer, obviously, there was a lot of tumult as well. With the Black Lives Matter protests over police killings of Black Americans, so many people of all colors came out to support those protests here in Los Angeles and across the country, and for that matter, around the world. Mm-hmm. Now this attack on the Capitol by Trump loyalists and even among them white supremacists and other groups with racist ideologies, what do you make of what's going on?
Nothing good. It's really frightening. You know, I try to look back and say much progress has been made. You know, Jim Crow laws fell, certain things changed, but the racial animus, the white supremacy that's always sort of, that's, you know, really the foundation of the country is really asserting itself or reasserting itself in a really obvious mainstream kind of way that I've never seen. What really, really makes me very uneasy is it's not that this is new stuff, but it's mainstream, and we have this kind of energy, this animus in the ranks of our elected officials, the plurality of the GOP, and I just don't have any idea how you work with that. So, you know, if they all left, we'd have basically half a Congress, and, you know, it's I'm drawing a blank when I think of what to do next, but I have to hold on to the fact that there were those protests last year, as you pointed out. There was a true kind of anti-racist awakening that's still in its early stages, but thank goodness we have that. But it's very, very much a hot front meeting a cold front. And there's already a clash that we're seeing between the sort of people who assert that America really is about white supremacy, and there's actually truth to that. And then the other side that says, no, we are better than that. We are a country that can become something else. And it's an age-old fight, but it feels very, very critical right now at this moment.
I mean, somebody was flying a Confederate flag in the middle of the U.S. Capitol. Mm-hmm. That didn't even happen during the Civil War in the United States.
Yes. You know, I look at those images, and as scary as they are, I try to tell myself that these are, you know, fringe malcontents, that we're just kind of watching this crazy reality show. We can change the channel, right? I think the problem with 2020 is that I think in the minds of many Americans who are watching this horror show, think that we can sort of reboot, reset ourselves. We have that ability or that we have that sort of, you know, cultural technology. We can just go back or just, you know, change course quickly, instantly. No, it's very clear that that can't happen. And again, I just worry about what I call the viral load. You know, we've always had white supremacy, racist ideology, which comes out in many, many different ways. We've had many, many warning signs over the years. But the viral load feels like, you know, we've kept it below a certain level, more or less. And now it's over the limit. You know, it's over the point where it, you know, it can't infect us. It has completely infected us. And how we uninfect ourselves, I don't know. It's just so interesting, too, that this coincides with the pandemic, of course, because, of course, we have a physical pandemic and really a political, really a spiritual pandemic of white anger, which is really at the root of everything. And, you know, the difference between now and all the years I've lived so far is that many people are embracing this openly. It is no longer a moral issue. As Dr. King, you know, at least made this a moral issue for the whole country. For many people, this is simply not a moral issue anymore. The moral issue for them is we need to restore America to, you know, the way it was before, or we need to assert our dominance. And that is their moral issue. It is not about bringing the country together. They're way past that.
Well, I think the predominant thought among the people who are protesting, the Trump loyalists and certainly those of the far right, are mm-hmm. that it is white victimhood, right? That the mm-hmm. pendulum yeah. has swung so far to the left that they're being excluded now, that they're the victims of racism. And we've seen this even in polls over the past couple of decades, that white people feel like there is racism against them. Isaac, what do you think about that? I mean, do you see Dr. King's dream being realized, or is there this, you know, multi-decade pushback?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I don't think that it's realized. I think we get symbolic gestures of realization from time to time, but at the substance and at the root, systemically, we're not seeing the change or the dream that Dr. King marched and spoke and died for play out. We see our first Black woman as vice president of the United States, which is an incredible victory for representation, but there's not a Black woman in the entire U.S. Senate now, right? And we are seeing unarmed Black people and Black people murdered by law enforcement, as we saw in the 60s, as we saw during the Black Codes, as we saw during the days of slave catching. And we still have the largest mass incarceration infrastructure in the entire world. And so Dr. King's dream has definitely not been realized. And this white rage that we've seen viscerally and lethally attack the U.S. Capitol and other places all around the country that we don't see on the news as visually is a pushback that I think is still tied to the election of Barack Obama, which was still undermined by a Senate that refused to confirm any of his judge appointments, Supreme Court nominations, and other powers that he held, yet still clapped back like the entire country had moved against white folks instead of towards a shared vision for the future. And I don't fully understand that, but I'm hopeful that we can move beyond it. And I think it's bigger than just the GOP and Democrats. I think it's more than right and left. It's rooted in economic instability and racial tensions that have been stoked and flamed for at least the last 4 years, but certainly longer than that by many others. And the COVID-19 pandemic has really just exacerbated some of those racial and social fissures that we always knew existed.
Your Black Policy Project over at UCLA is focused on, quote, community-driven research that helps spur policy change. What are you seeing in the community, specifically of Los Angeles? I mean, that obviously a lot needs to change.
Yeah, and that's why I say it's bigger than right and left, because in Los Angeles and in the state of California, you have Democratic leadership throughout, yet we still have one of the largest unhoused populations anywhere in the world. And over 40% of our unhoused population is Black folks, despite Black people only making 8% of the county, right? There's some racial problems there. Our law enforcement institutions, the LAPD in particular, killed more people than any other law enforcement agency in the country last year. We have the largest jail infrastructure in the entire country at 17,000 per day. We have huge economic divisions between those who have and those who have not, and it teeters on racial lines. We have a lack of health infrastructure in communities of color. We have a lack of food infrastructure in communities of color. And so Dr. King's dream has not been realized here in Los Angeles, but I am hopeful because we do have the kind of leadership, the kind of community mobilization that does spur change. We passed some incredible ballot initiatives and we elected some incredible elected officials this last November, and the largest protest in the country in response to George Floyd's murder happened right here in Los Angeles. So I have hope and I keep faith alive, but we have a lot of issues we need to address.
Hey, Aaron, do you think the fact that, you know, I mean, we don't have, at least not in the books, we don't have Jim Crow laws anymore. We don't have, you know, there's, I mean, at least legally, discrimination is illegal. But the fact that those laws don't exist anymore, does it make it harder, do you think, to really measure where we are in terms of racial equality now that there aren't the legal barriers?
It's harder to measure for white people. Black people who experience discrimination, I think it's much easier to measure, but it's hard to convince everyone else that it's still very much in place. And, you know, I think Isaac mentioned this. We've had this long backlash, not just to Barack Obama, but going back to the 60s and the unleashing of civil rights, or just the assertion of the rights that were already guaranteed in the Constitution. You know, it's so funny. We think of that as so revolutionary when, in fact, all they're trying to do in the 60s was enforce the 15th Amendment, you know, enforce the 14th Amendment. It wasn't anything all that new. But I think the last official vestiges of Jim Crow fell in the 60s. But we're still struggling with the Voting Rights Act. We're still struggling with voting voter rights in southern states, but kind of not just southern states. So, you know, it's voting that's led to this very perilous moment. You know, this assertion that on one side, that the election was not legitimate. Why? Because, you know, the not so coded rationale is because all these illegitimate people voted in places like Detroit and Philadelphia and Atlanta, you know. So it is, you know, we're still very much in that struggle of the Jim Crow-like struggle. You know, Jim Crow is officially gone. And I'll just add, you know, my family came here from the South in the 40s, beginning in the 40s, to escape Jim Crow. They found in Los Angeles, not Jim Crow laws, but a lot of Jim Crow traditions that were just as powerful and that held for a long time into the 60s and past that. So, you know, it's been a constant struggle.
Aaron Kaplan, a journalist, opinion writer, and Isaac Bryan, who heads up the Black Policy Project over at UCLA. Happy Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day to both of you, and let's see how far the dream goes. It's certainly a struggle for a lot of folks. Thanks to you both.
Thank you, Steve.
And great to be with you. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I'm gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching up to freedom land. Ain't gonna let no jailhouse turn me around.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. It is a time of pain and unease for way too many friends and neighbors all across the country. You know who you look for?
You know, my mother used to say, always look for the helpers. Anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy. Oh, baby, how can I get a little help for my pain? All I need is my brother. Because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
Like the vast majority of restaurants in L.A. and beyond, Hot and Cool Cafe off Crenshaw and Leimert Boulevards has had a rough year. When they had to shut down the dining room at the beginning of the pandemic, husband and wife team, Tina Amin and Anthony Jolly, began making free lunches for their elderly neighbors. Well, 10 months later, they're still at it, and the program has grown. And Tina Amin is here to talk to me about it, about how it's going. Hey, Tina.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm all right. How are you doing, I guess, is the question to ask.
We're hanging in there, just forging through.
I want to start back in March when your cafe was forced to shut down the dining area. What made you pivot to serving senior citizens in the community?
Well, you know, a couple of weeks after the shutdown, we got an email from Marquise Harris Dawson's office in the 9th District. And he told us about a program they were doing where they were using local restaurants to serve meals to those in need. We became a part of his program, which was amazing and helped us stay afloat. But a couple of weeks into the program, we started getting calls from neighbors in our district. We're in the 10th District. And they wanted to be part of the program. You know, the program served the 9th District seniors, not the 10th District seniors. So we decided to start our own program.
Were you still in business doing takeout and delivery at that time as well?
Yeah, you know, we opened up the shop every day. It was nearly empty. For the first 3 months of the pandemic, we had maybe a few people walk in a day, but principally, we were just there staying open for the community, you know, if they wanted something, but we did not have a lot of customers.
Let's talk about the program itself and exactly what it does. You make the food, the to-go plate, and then you dish it out. How does that happen and who does it go to?
We plan the meals at the beginning of the week. You know, our staff, are the owners, you know, whoever is available, shops for the ingredients. We cook everything in our restaurant. We individually plate the meals. You know, one of the reasons we started this program was to make sure that seniors and community members were getting fresh meals, well balanced with the protein and the vegetable, you know, and not just, you know, a grab bag of you know, snacks and things like that. So we plate each meal individually. For the seniors, we hand deliver it. So we have routes that we've created. For all of the seniors who get personally delivered to their homes, we deliver to a senior living center in Limerick Park. Sometimes we hand out the meals at our community fridge, which is right outside of our establishment that started this summer. And, you know, sometimes we do various giveaways, you know, around the city if it's something that's pre-planned.
We know, Tina, that Black people have been disproportionately affected by this pandemic, heartbreakingly. We also know that there's a whole lot of food insecurity in the neighborhood as well, right? So how did those things factor in to the people you serve?
Yeah, you know, it really became apparent this year. You know, it's always been there, the food insecurity and the food access problems, because, you know, where we are in South LA and Limerick Park, there's not a lot of healthy food options. A lot of people don't have vehicles, and, you know, the convenience stores and fast food restaurants are on the corners, you know, readily available, but, you know, that healthy, you know, food is less accessible. And so that was one of the reasons that we decided to both start the program. You know, we want to prepare healthy, fresh meals and to deliver it to seniors, because a lot of these folks, they can't come out, you know, they can't come out during the pandemic. There's a lot of fear and anxiety about getting the virus. So, you know, we wanted to deliver it to them.
We're having this conversation, Tina, on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day. What connections do you draw between the work you're doing and the work he was doing?
Some people might remember that Martin Luther King had started a poor people's campaign in 1968. And this campaign was an imperative to, you know, address the economic injustice in addition to the legal, you know, the legal justice issues that he had been working on. And, you know, he basically told us that we have a moral imperative to lift each other up. And food access is an economic issue for our community. And so, you know, we can only hope that doing this little bit will help, you know, carry on his legacy and bring it forth to his people.
Tina Amin, the co-owner of Hot and Cool Cafe in Limerick Park, she and her husband running the free lunch program for senior citizens through the neighborhood. Tina, God bless you. I hope the universe blesses you. Thanks for all that you're doing.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's going to do it for us today. We wish you a time of reflection and introspection on this Dr. Martin Luther King Day, a time of thinking about your place in history. Tomorrow, 2 weeks after the Capitol insurrection by domestic terrorists, who's going to the inauguration from L.A. and why? We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast. Tell us how you're doing, too. kcrw.com/greaterLA. Catherine Barnes, Kaylee Wells, Sonia Geis, Kat Yor, Ray Guarna, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Amy Toss, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on the show this evening. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thanks for your ears and your attention. And have a great night.